While I'm loading, let me tell you a little bit about who I am and what my union does. I'm Richard Thomason, the policy director for the United Healthcare Workers West Local of the Service Employees International Union. SEIU has about 700,000 members up and down the state, state workers, public sector workers at the state, at the county level, healthcare workers, property services workers. Our local has about 150,000 of those members. We are hospital workers in the private hospitals that are closing around Los Angeles. I couldn't agree more about what Howard just said, so I'm not going to contradict you there. We represent workers in Kaiser, workers in clinics up and down the state, nursing home workers, for example, in Fresno, home care workers in Fresno and other parts of Northern California. So that's who we are. For example, we're the folks who are on strike at Daughters of Charity and Sutter Hospitals today, so that would be St. Francis and St. Vincent for folks in Los Angeles. So what I wanted to talk about today was the labor perspective on healthcare reform, give you a little bit of detail and inside baseball about what happened over the last year or two, talk some about what I think is going to happen over the next year or so, which will be another exciting year for healthcare reform, especially depending on what the presidential election holds for us. But, you know, it's really true that for many of us in the labor movement, and especially at UHW, healthcare reform is really a key goal, and it's something we think about every day and we work on every day, primarily as a matter of social and economic justice. We really believe that all Americans deserve quality, affordable healthcare, and that healthcare is a right that should be accessible to all. So working in Sacramento, across the state, nationally, our local has been pretty relentless, right, Fig, in pushing healthcare reform and in lobbying in Sacramento and in local efforts as well to improve access to care. What's also driving our demand for healthcare reform is, of course, that healthcare system in our country fails too many of us. And, you know, we all know the statistics about rising costs. In the interest of time, I won't go through them. Healthcare costs are rising. It's harder for workers, harder for employers to afford buying healthcare coverage. Cost is rising much faster than median earnings. This is causing more and more pressure on more and more Californians who can't afford their medical bills, who therefore are filing for bankruptcy in record numbers because of medical bills. In addition, we know from studies that the quality of care is inadequate. Barely half of U.S. adults receive the required or recommended clinical screening tests and preventive care. International comparisons show that American healthcare system is substantially underperforming most other developed nations. We have too many healthcare disparities, as was pointed out earlier, affecting all of the communities of color within California. If you live in South Central Los Angeles, you will have noticed that hospitals there, for example, are closing at an alarming rate. And if you look at the map of healthcare services, primary care, specialty care that's available in South Central, it really is shocking at the medical apartheid that we have allowed to happen there. So that's just one example of how we as a society have allowed the healthcare system to collapse around us, and that, you know, we're really paying more and getting less from our healthcare system. Of course, we all familiar with the statistics about the uninsured. What's important to us, though, is to recognize, as was pointed out earlier, that most of the uninsured, 80%, are legal workers and their family members. So it's really a problem that affects working people in the state, and far too many workers don't get health care through their jobs. Far too many workers are uninsured. The rising cost of health care, of course, also affects us at the bargaining table. It leads to conflicts with our employers, and so from labor's point of view, the choice that we too often face is getting better pay for healthcare costs, getting those covered, or getting raises. And there's trade-offs there that too often workers are forced to to balance. So all of these imperatives have really focused labor's attention on healthcare reform. So in the last 5 years, we've worked very hard on a number of efforts. SB2, which was the employer payer play bill in 2003 that was defeated at a referendum, very narrowly though, and that really, I think, surprised a lot of us just how close we were to winning payer play at the ballot then, and has encouraged us all to keep fighting here. We've worked on efforts to cover all children, labor, many elements in labor support single payer and really view that as the solution. That has been worked on substantially with Senator Kuhl, moved through the legislature several times and vetoed several times, as well as there was substantial labor involvement in ABX11 and its predecessor AB8, the different health care reform bills that were considered in 2007 and then defeated in the state Senate in 2008. So here are some consistent threads that I think really mark labor's approach to health care in California. We support coverage expansions, and we see that as really critical. We support expansions of public programs because we view that as a key element of supporting the safety net providers that we need. We seek to level the playing field among employers so that all employers contribute a certain level to their workers' health care, so that no longer do you have it be a competitive advantage in some industries for employers not to provide health care to their employees. We support efforts to stabilize the safety net, and we're trying to move public policy towards more pooling of risk rather than towards a healthcare system where we're all on our own. Good luck to each of you. Here's some money. Go out and buy some healthcare. Good luck. So throughout the discussions around ABX11 and AB8, what we were trying to do was to create new opportunities and new venues for pooling, for bringing people together in a public purchasing pool or expanding Medi-Cal and healthy families. Sadly, 2008 turned out not to be the year of healthcare reform. You know, we began with much promise with ABX11 having passed the assembly. Then it ran into the Senate and was made short work of there. You know, at that point, early this year, the budget had started going south. That had caused a lot of members in the legislature to increasingly question the cost of the legislation. And, you know, there were a number of members of the legislature who were supporting single payer and not this. And so that really helped defeat the bill in the Senate. Labor ended up being split on ABX11. Some of the large unions like SEIU and AFSCME supported it because it would end up covering a large chunk of the uninsured in California. It would expand public programs, like I said, create a threshold for employer contribution, reform the insurance market, and create a public insurer of the local initiative health plans, increase Medi-Cal rates, etc. But there was strong opposition to ABX11, coming from some of the unions like the California Nurses Association and the school employees, who really viewed single payer as the answer and who took the position that anything that bolsters the private insurance system is really a distraction and not going to move us towards a truly reformed healthcare system. As well, there were other unions like the Teamsters, the Machinists, and UFCW, the Food and Commercial Workers, who looked at the construction of ABX11 and thought that the pooling, the way we had created the state purchasing pool, would encourage employers with a lot of low-wage workers to dump them into the pool rather than maintain or improve their existing employer-provided coverage. They were also concerned about the individual mandate that was a part of it and whether or not there were real there was enough in there to make coverage affordable to people that we would have been mandating by it. Also, what happened after the defeat of ABX11 is that, unfortunately, labor and healthcare advocates continued to lose ground over the course of the year. The slowing economy, the past tax cuts, the VLF reduction from several years ago, joined to create this really terrible budget stalemate, which lasted months and months until they finally reached a budget in September, which we've found out over the last week is, I guess, really not worth the paper it was printed on, and so the governor is now calling a special session to come back in with the lame duck legislature over the course of November to try and deal with what is a $3 to $10 billion budget deficit that that has reemerged. You know, the budget deficit has been very hard to close this year, though, because the two-thirds vote requirement really allows the minority Republicans in the legislature to hold fast against any kind of revenue increase that we very much believe is needed in order to preserve public programs and to keep our healthcare system, our education system, continuing to function. Unfortunately, neither the governor nor anybody else has been able to find the ability or the power to get Republicans to vote for a revenue increase. So that left this budget stalemate, leading to a resolution that moved us backwards in a variety of programs, caused reductions in healthcare services that, yeah, they weren't as bad as originally proposed, but they still, some of the changes like to Medi-Cal enrollment for kids will mean that over 3 years, as many as 250,000 children will lose Medi-Cal coverage. There's a delay in implementation of efforts to improve enrollment in healthy families and Medi-Cal. Higher premiums for some folks on Medi-Cal and for healthy family subscribers. Benefit reductions, limits on dental coverage for adults in Medi-Cal. Further delay in creating a state discount drug program, which could really allow uninsured people to get drugs at a lower cost. And then payment cuts. You know, Medi-Cal is already a severely underfunded, starved system. Low Medi-Cal rates is one of the reasons why these private hospitals are closing, one of the reasons why physicians are stopping to take care of Medi-Cal patients. So what do? We cut payments for many Medi-Cal providers even further. That's only going to cause further erosions in access and coverage. Finally, one of the really most frightening things that came out of this year's budget discussion was this budget reform that the legislature and the governor agreed to that will be put on the ballot next year that we all will get to vote on, and it's a constitutional amendment that will further straitjacket California spending so that there's a rainy day fund that needs to be created. It's going to serve as something like a roach motel of spending because they made it very easy to put money in and have requirements for putting money in, and then it's very hard to get the money out even when there are programs already underfunded, even when we're already not meeting the needs of the people for health care and education. We're going to stick money away in this fund. It's going to grow and be an irresistible urge for folks to look at to say, just like with Prop 13, hey, the state's got all this money sitting around. We need to cut taxes, and that's what we're going to do. So the budget reform proposal coming up at the next election, possibly June, maybe fig knows, who knows, whenever the governor calls it, that could really do permanent damage to healthcare programs in California, human services, all the programs that we care about. So that is, for us, one of the worst things that's come out of this year's budget situation. So with all that background, what did we do in the healthcare reform debate this year? So it evolved into a discussion of, can we take some incremental steps with different pieces of legislation in order to try to move the ball forward, in order to try and create some areas where, you make changes in the insurance market in ways that will support further reform farther down the road. Some of the increment, so labor focused on a variety of different legislative proposals that would restrict the ability of HMOs and insurers to rescind coverage after somebody obtains services, that would require state regulators to create five classes of coverage in the individual insurance market so that people buying individual coverage can better compare plans and better compare prices and costs and coverage. There's a various other efforts to create a public health insurer, to create minimum loss ratios for HMOs, etc. A number of those bills ended up getting defeated through the legislative process. Particular opposition from hospitals, insurers, and physicians stopped a lot of things that they didn't like. Some of them, like the minimum medical loss ratio and the one of the rescission bills, made it to the governor's desk, and some of them got vetoed even after it appeared he supported them and then he was against them. So we were left a little confused about where the governor ended up on some of these specific issues. Single payer, of course, went through again and got vetoed. So we really ended up this year with very little in the way of health care reform. Some new restrictions on balance billing, some new requirements on hospitals to do better infection control. That's about it. So much for the year of reform. So what's next? So we've got this special session on the budget coming up. That's going to put forward undoubtedly more proposals to cut healthcare services. So we're going to have to be fighting about that. The governor has stated his interest to continue to work on healthcare reform over the remaining 2 years of his term. So I'm sure we'll hear some more from Fig about that. Then, of course, we've got the election, and what happens, who wins, is going to have a big effect on where we all go next year. Okay, let me just finish up on sort of what's labor's agenda for next year. And, you know, we view it that we have to move forward on all fronts simultaneously to fight for a responsible state budget. Many unions are going to continue to advocate for single payer, both at the state and the federal level. There will be a big push around health care reform at the federal level if Obama wins. And if McCain wins, there's going to be a big push at the federal level to try and prevent some of the very dangerous proposals that he's put forward, like ending the employer tax deduction for health care. We will have a big fight around this budget reform constitutional amendment next year when that comes up. And then we're going to continue to work on looking at and solving the policy and political problems that ended up defeating ABX11. We'll look at whether it's possible to push a broad reform measure in the legislature. We'll be looking at, are there options for taking something to the ballot in 2010? And then we will also work with our consumer allies and the legislature on some of these different incremental bills that I talked about. Many of them will come forward again next year. So let me end there.
And our last speaker is Richard Figueroa.
I turned my BlackBerry off so you won't hear any more of that in the background. I guess we're supposed to say we have no conflicts. I have no conflicts, and neither do you two. You didn't say it. I'll say it for you. Anyway, I'm Richard Figueroa. I'm a Deputy Cabinet Secretary in the Office of the Governor. And what I want to talk a little bit about is kind of what was driving the governor behind his proposal for comprehensive health care reform and kind of our views of kind of what happened this past year and a little bit about kind of where his head is at right now. I'll get this back to you. So his motivations behind comprehensive health care reform were very clear, and he was spent, you know, 8 or 9 months, you know, wandering around the state talking about what his motivations were. Basically, that the status quo was not acceptable for both the insured and uninsured alike, that the system was broken, that the increase we're seeing in premiums, and all these things have been alluded to by the other presenters, really unsustainable in the long term. You know, business and the state of it can't continue to sustain, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12, 15% increases year over year. That there are ever larger amounts of the uninsured and the underinsured, both which kind of contribute to what we call the hidden tax, and it was alluded to earlier, which is the amount that paying employers pay or have to make up for in the system because of all the uninsured that are still, you know, they still go to the ERs, there's still some cost for them in the system that has to be borne by the system somewhere, as well as underpayments. You know, we're a bad payer. You know, our Medi-Cal payments suck. And so I get in trouble for that all the time, but I say it anyway. Fig, we're going to get sued. Well, we already are being sued. Anyway, so our Medi-Cal payments, you know, we've always, Medi-Cal in California, doesn't make a difference who the governor is, who's been in charge of the legislature, very broad on eligibility, very skimpy on payments. It's not an ideological thing. It's just the way Medicaid is here. And it's been that way for 30 years. And some of the people in the audience who work for DHCS know this. So we got to do, so that's a big part of the hidden tax, too. It's not just the no payment. It's the underpayment on the part of the state that has to be made up somewhere. Lack of attention to primary and preventive care, lack of focus on chronic care management, and kind of the increasing unease that folks that are insured feel about being one step away from potential bankruptcy due to medical bills if they like lose that coverage. So what we tried to do, and the product we put together was kind of a trade-off of a whole variety of things that really do think can be a national model, and depending on who the next president is, they would emphasize some portions of the model versus other portions of the model. But just to kind of recap the bidding for a second, and Richard did a little bit of this, we were trying to cover or expand access for nearly all of California's 5.1 million uninsured. And that's at like any one time. There's like 7 million people uninsured at some point during the year. Coverage for all lower-income kids, regardless of immigration status, and Howard kind of talked about that. Endorsement of the principle of personal responsibility for coverage, the individual mandate, and Richard's talked a little bit about the controversies about that. The endorsement of the principle of shared responsibility for financing, that there's a whole lot of different players that should be contributing toward making this work, including a minimum employer contribution. And Richard, again, talked a little bit about the controversy within the unions about was it too high, was it too low, so people kind of fell different places at that. Affordability mechanisms that reach two-thirds of the uninsured. We're going to get a subsidy of some sort. At the bottom end, it was more Medi-Cal for new populations, more coverage for, like, for example, the first time, healthy families would really be healthy families. We put the families in healthy families by letting them cover the kids, the parents of those kids in the program. There would even be a tax credit for folks above the healthy families level. So if it's an Obama that's president, he'd probably be more focused on the lower end, expanding Medi-Cal or Medicaid, healthy families. If McCain's president, it'd be more at the top end of what we're talking about because he favors more the kind of the tax credits kind of system. Sweeping insurance market reforms, transparency and public reporting, which I think is a major quality and cost reduction effort in the long term. Safety net provider protections, and Howard talked a little bit about that. Hundreds of millions of dollars for clinics, so that even if, you know, the issue of the uninsured or the undocumented was just so difficult to deal with, but what we tried to do for the first time was put hundreds of millions more in the clinics and try to establish a new system where even the undocumented would have a medical home. There'd be a place they could go to. There'd be a card, something they could use in an expanded clinic system. Comprehensive health and wellness, including a focus on obesity and chronic care management, which I know is a lot of the people in the audience are very concerned about, and Medi-Cal provider rate increases to reduce the hidden tax. So why did it fail? And I think for every 10 persons you talk to, you're going to get 10 different reasons, and they have touched on some of these things. First, there were divisions on the Senate panel itself. You got the single-payer folks over here, you know, who want more of a totally public system. And on the other end, you have folks that completely believe in just market-based strategies. And you see a lot of that tension in the national debate as well. I think ours was fundamentally in the middle, but not at the extremes. It envisioned a role for the private sector, private market, but with stronger market reforms. It also envisioned an expanded role for government, because we were trying to expand Medi-Cal and expand healthy families to include parents. It reflected our attempt to find a reasonable and responsible alternative to any single preferred approach. Because at these two ends, they may be single preferred approaches, but there is no, and it was mentioned earlier in this, there's no societal consensus about tackling it either just from the market-based side or from the single payer side. So we tried to find a reasonable, responsible alternative to the status quo, which everybody agrees is unsustainable. So, and the governor, he's not going to change his views on this. He does like the middle approach. He's not going to go this way or he's not going to go that way. He's going to continue down this middle path. You talked about the budget issue. It happened to be, even though we didn't know at the time, that our budget or that our healthcare plan cost $14 billion. None of it was general fund. None of it was from the proceeds of taxes, the taxes we pay in April and stuff like that. It was all through other mechanisms, federal dollars, an assessment on hospitals, employer contributions, individual contributions, et cetera, tobacco tax. They were all funding streams outside the general fund because we knew the budget was going to be bad. Well, it just so happens that the budget, deficit ended up also being $14 billion. So it just was bad, not good, bad juju that the numbers were the same, even though they were not related. This was a general fund problem. This was a non-general fund issue. So, so we didn't rely on some vague promise of future funding. They were real funds. It took a while to get people to realize the feds really were going to pony up. We got a letter that said they were. And then we had triggers to stop the programs if either the financing didn't occur or it wasn't enough. So I don't think the governor again is not going to move away from the shared responsibility concept. Clearly, given our budget situation, relying on the general fund for any kind of comprehensive solutions would be very, very difficult. The third issue, and one that will come up at both the state and federal level, is the cost of this thing. And for us, everything you do this big has some risk. The Legislative Analyst Office, which is like the nonpartisan fiscal office here, was really concerned about the cost of this thing. Well, it turned out they were worried that, the third or fourth year in the program, we'd be $2 billion upside down, which is like was way out a way number of years beyond what we were thinking. But it's mostly because they thought the monthly premium for coverage for the purchasing pool part, like for the parents of these healthy families' kids, was going to be $300 a month. We thought it was $250. And that increment ended up being, over time, times hundreds of thousands of people, a couple $1 billion shortfall. Some of the members of the legislature said, that's a great concern to us. This is going to be upside down in a couple years. Despite the fact that we pay our Medi-Cal contractors 30% less than that, and despite the fact that health plan partners who would be partnering with us said, yeah, we can do it for that cost. So, there is enough ammo in that independent fiscal analysis for those, if they wanted to say yes, we think there's enough in that independent fiscal analysis for those that wanted to move ahead to say, yes, it's balanced enough for us to vote aye at this point. But there are also enough ammo in there for those who were concerned about the fiscal effect several years down the road to cite the risks and vote no. We obviously wanted them to vote yes because we thought we could provide the product for that amount. But again, you can't do something this big without risk, and the risks were several years down the road. So, but again, some people seized on that as that's a reason to vote no, mostly Democrats, interestingly enough. The fourth issue was one of timing. This was a very, the budget was very delayed in the previous year. Of course, this past year was even worse, but the previous year was bad enough. And because of the two-thirds vote requirement, it was very clear to the governor we weren't going to get votes out of Republicans to do anything. So we'd have to go to the ballot to do it. And because of the timing on the ballot, we had to file the ballot initiative even before the Senate vote, which caused a real problem for people. But it's just because of the timing of all this and because we had this unique two-thirds requirement that was really problematic for us. Now, this is not to say we didn't have opposition, because we did, and Richard and others have talked a little bit about this, single-payer folks, California Medical Association, and labor unions, et cetera, and they had a big head of steam. For us, because of all the different complicated machinations of putting together something this big, our coalition of support came together pretty late, and so in some ways, we got a pretty late start with our final coalition of making a final push to get this thing done. So I think, even though we were very disappointed about what happened, the governor still points with pride to what was accomplished during that 10 months of debate or so. The public awareness of healthcare went way up. We had 70%+ support for the overall comprehensive package during that time. We could have filled up a cemetery with the number of articles over that year indicating it was dead, 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 but we kept meeting and pushing and pushing. So I think the governor believes we have a great framework for moving forward. We built an unusual and really unprecedented coalition to get behind this thing. What did we learn? Timing is critical, particularly if you have competing priorities like a fiscal crisis. I do not know, standing here today, what we're going to do, you know, next year in terms of how we might be able to move forward. As several of the speakers have noted, we don't even know how big of a budget hole we're dealing with in the current year right now and how big it's going to be in the budget year. And, you know, if we do have to propose other cuts, particularly on the healthcare side, at the same time you're doing healthcare reform, the optics are pretty hard to explain to the public. Gee, you're cutting healthcare, but at the same time you're trying to expand healthcare for a new population. And what are you going to do about the money you had to cut here? Well, you got to make it up somewhere in this new package so these folks that you're cutting come back into the system. So I don't know today what we're going to do. The governor has lots of very difficult decisions to be made. We learned it's easier to stop reform than to enact reform. We were trying to change the paradigm so that everyone's second choice wouldn't be the status quo. That's very hard to do. And so it's very easy for people to just kind of fall back into the status quo because at least they haven't lost what they currently have. And so even though we were creating a bigger pie, which kept people at the table, it's still easy for people to fall back into their old habits of, well, at least I'm not going to lose anything, so I'm just going to pose a thing. You got to keep the issue in the public eye, which we did. We got to build our coalition as soon as possible, a lot earlier than we did this last go-around, certainly. More is more. Comprehensive versus incremental. They've talked a little bit about incremental steps. Do we just go for kids? Do we not? It was easier for us to go for comprehensive and move it all together because individually these things are too easy to pick off and too easy to oppose. If you have a more comprehensive package, there's usually enough in there for most people that even if they don't like one element, there's something else in their form that they might like, and so they're willing to kind of, well, I guess so. I don't like that, but I there's other thing I really want. So comprehensive, I think, is still a better strategy. Whether we can pull it off in this kind of, I know I got 2 minutes. Whether we can pull it off in this environment, I do not know. So I think the governor, you know, I've worked for three governors now in various capacities, and this one is just like, it's the optimism is kind of like in his DNA somewhere. It's just really kind of weird. So, like, defeat is not in his vocabulary, and retreat is not in his genetic makeup. It's not there. It just ain't there. And I think he believes that he was able, he really does like the package he put together. He was very engaged and very involved, and several of you were in meetings with him personally about this where he was engaged and involved and wanted to talk to people and wanted to learn. So I think to him, what we did last year demonstrated that traditional interests are able to step outside their normal comfort zone and do something they haven't done before. To put in fact, SEIU, LA Care, and LCHC were actually with us and supported with us in the end. And we might have never had normally, they're not always the bedfellows and certainly never with the governor's office all the time, particularly a Republican governor, but we were able to do that. So I think he views what we did is people were able to step outside their traditional comfort zones. He did in July, I guess, given we got stuck in February with the big kahuna, in July he put forth a smaller, more targeted series of bills. The legislature just picked a couple of them to do. The governor ended up vetoing the couple that made it to him, even though he supported the concepts, because he really had wanted them to do more of what he sent them in July. So that was kind of, I think, disappointing for a lot of folks, including myself in some way. So again, now the governor has to figure out kind of like what he wants to do. I think, you know, we all know healthcare reform is not for the faint of heart. It's just not for the faint of heart. And government is where the tough issues come and people expect us to do something about them. So I think from the governor's perspective, I'm wrapping up. So I think from his perspective, his goals remain, his commitment to lead remains, and his resolve remains. What I can't tell you today is exactly what we're going to do, because he's really focused right now. I'm just trying to figure out how big is this budget mess we have to deal with. And whoever he, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Whatever he decides to do on the budget, you know, particularly if it ends up like, you know, cutting healthcare, doing things, is going to have major implications for what we can do moving forward, because it will certainly be viewed by all the players here that way, as well as the general public. So I don't know yet, and, you know, we obviously didn't expect to be in this situation just having a long protracted budget issue. I didn't expect to be in a situation where a month later I'm here telling you we may have, you know, we have clearly have a multi-billion-dollar problem, if not double-digit, billion-dollar problem that we're going to have to face. So that is clearly, you know, there are clouds on my healthcare horizon, and I'm still trying to figure out if the sun's going to shine through or not because the governor doesn't know himself. So, I
finished. Thank you. I want to. We have about 10 minutes, and I wanted to provide an opportunity for people in the audience to ask questions. So let's start right up here.
Folks that are receiving the services are both documented and undocumented, and as you know, both documented and undocumented for delivery, the feds pay for half of it. So they're kind of gotten a little sticky about residency requirements, citizenship requirements, identification requirements, and maybe even requiring people to go through a full Medi-Cal screen, like at the county level, which we think, as you know, for family planning, people come in. They want the services then. We have right now it's point of service. You know, you just do a quick check, make sure that they become eligible, and you get the services right there, right at that moment. So the feds are doing a whole bunch of things, not only this, but a lot of other things in the states too that we're fighting. And we will know in the next week installing. Yes, don't do this. I don't know if we'll make it the next month, we're trying. we're trying, negotiating with the feds. But they're really, really being sticky. We're afraid we'll lose several hundred million dollars in federal dollars here. And in the process, have to pick it up on the general fund side, or half the people will just go away. They won't get the family plans. They'll just fall off. They'll never show their, never want to come back in to show their ID, or they won't have any documentation at all at the point of service. So it's really a problem. The governor has been very, and former Governor Pete Wilson, who started this, have both been very, very, very active in calling the president and calling Republican and Democratic congressional folks about this right now, trying to say what has been a wonderful program for California and a wonderful program for providers. But it's just really, really, this administration really, really tough on us.
Okay, we have time for two other questions. Yes, over here and then there.
The heck hope not. One of the things that we have tried to do, we've just had the obesity and diabetes, do some fun pre-diabetes programs, fun community makeovers related to obesity, like large public health messaging, not just relying on Howard, although the providers are very, very good, I'm sure, but doing a lot of general public health messaging, continuing our funding for the community clinics, understanding people do fall through the cracks, understanding that public health messaging can make, like smoking, can make major societal changes that help the overall public health. So we weren't relying totally on what Howard's providers could provide, because we knew that the continued public health messaging, there was still a role for them to play, even in a situation where you had more universal, but not complete universal.
Yeah, let me add something to that, which is that if you look around at countries that have universal coverage, which are most Western countries that have any real wealth, they actually go more toward prevention. Because it's back to what I was saying earlier about take one of the issues away, coverage, and you're dealing with cost and quality. Well, in my mind, prevention is part of the quality, and it has an impact on cost. So when you go to a place like a Sweden or a Great Britain, you typically will see that they're doing a lot around the prevention side. Now, there's one caveat to that, which is a very interesting case study. Who led in the world the whole issue around stopping smoking, which was identified as the most expensive and detrimental health issue? Ironically, it was the U.S. that really led that all around the world. So it's not always a rule that way, but usually places that have universal coverage push more toward prevention and really look at the whole equation. Because finally, blood on the emergency room steps trumps immunizations every time.
We have another question right here, so I want to make sure we catch it. Yes, up here.
The governor has demonstrated his displeasure with single payer. And I wouldn't advocate that we stop trying, but I am interested in Sheila Quill had a bill that would reform healthcare insurance so that it would affect their profits and,
sure.
and reduce the,
yep.
the amount
of medical losses.
And I'm wondering what the governor feels about strategies like that, that just start holding the insurance company's feet to the fire a little bit more, doesn't cost the state anything. I mean, I know it's contrary to some Republican ideology.
It's not contrary to ideology at all. He proposed it. He proposed it as part of his health care plan. He still supports. The issue was is. It ended up coming down to him as a single individual bill versus part of the comprehensive package. So he was fine with it as part of the comprehensive package. He was not so fine with it as a single individual measure without some of the other elements that related to the market around it. And Richard, you might want to think of that too.
That was one of the bills I was talking about that many observers, including us, were puzzled that he vetoed it after he put it out there as something that he supported as part of this package of, sort of dogs and cats of various, really kind of small to medium ideas that he would support. So, that idea, I imagine, will come back
next year as legislation.
But I think the
insurers have always hated it. The governor's always liked it.
But there's some hope chipping away at small strategies.
Let me just say that if you do that, and I'm not in that side of the market at all, because I'm a public agency and we don't have problems with the percentage.
But it would apply to you.
But it would apply to us, but it doesn't bother me in my organization. What it might do, though, is destroy what's left of the individual market. Because the administrative costs of the individual market, because of the marketing costs, personally, I don't like the individual market. I think it's a sign of a bunch of failures. But it might destroy the individual market. Because the admin costs, sales costs are so high, people will say, okay, I got to put my costs down, what I need to do.
We gain some flexibility.
I'm talking about
if you
do the vacuum.
Okay, so I want to thank everybody. They'll stay here for a few minutes if you have any questions, but I want to give a hand to this great panel. And thank you for coming.
Right now. I'm going to